This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. About 6 months ago, I interviewed a young man who had announced that he was a candidate for the presidency. He was an up-and-comer in Democratic politics. In fact, Barack Obama mentioned him to me back in 2016. But as the mayor of a small city in Indiana, he had had less exposure than almost any figure in the race. And while we were preparing for the interview, the hardest question my producers tackled was how to pronounce his name. But in the months since, we've all learned to say Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg. Even Donald Trump has learned it. As a Midwesterner, Buttigieg counts on support in Iowa to lift his candidacy. And that tactic seems to be working out. Recently, an Iowa State University poll put him in second place to Elizabeth Warren, just a hair past Bernie Sanders, and significantly ahead of Joe Biden. I had a chance to sit down again with Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete as the campaign calls him, in front of a live audience at the New Yorker Festival in October.
Let's start with the news. Let's get the DT stuff out of the way. Is Donald Trump's political goose cooked?
That depends on the conscience of the Senate Republicans. And what that actually means is it depends on whether there is enough of a threat to the power of the Senate Republicans that they would be reunited with their conscience, which obviously they've taken a holiday from. Which is really important because in a moral sense and in a constitutional sense, this is about accountability when the president has admitted to an abuse of power. And I think this is one thing we need to be really clear on. There's going to be an investigation, there's going to be testimony, there's going to be records, but for all the things that might emerge then, he confessed on television to the abuse of power. So in addition to everything else that might emerge, and the fact that more people might go to jail over this, there's the central fact that Congress has to weigh in on whether this is or is not a high crime. For all of that, we also know that this is a political process. Of course, as a presidential candidate, you have no real part in that. And so my perspective is to focus on the day after Trump is president. Because one way or the other, this presidency is coming to an end. But I want to ask you to really picture what it's going to be like that first day when the sun comes up. At first it's a happy thought, for sure. But then you really think about it. Like, what's it going to be like? Like, the rubble of our norms and institutions. And our population, our families maybe, our communities, even more torn apart by politics than we are now. If you think about everything we've been through and everything we're about to go through. And the real question is, who among the candidates for president can lead us? And of course, I'm running to be that president because we need somebody capable of turning the page as well as winning the fight.
But before the sun goes up, we have to acknowledge some realities. That the Senate Republicans are where they are because we live in a very different environment, media environment and social media environment, all the rest, than we were living in 1974 during the Watergate crisis. You have a base that President Trump has not lost. What is it going to take, do you think, to change the equation that President Trump set out when he was a candidate and said, I could go down Fifth Avenue and shoot anybody I want, or whatever the quote was, and nobody would care? That still seems to be the case when we're talking about his base and therefore the Senate Republicans.
Well, the day that Nixon resigned, I'm told, he had about 25% of the country with him. So I think we can assume that there's at least 25% that you're just not going to reach. That still leaves an awful lot of people. And we're talking about my neighbors. I'm from the industrial Midwest. There are a lot of people where I live. They don't think he's a good guy. They're not stupid. But they voted effectively to burn the house down. And it's not just Republican, actually. I mean, this is kind of a problem of the era that we've lived in. I was born in 1982. That means that I've spent... I hear that murmur. See what that... It means I'm an elder millennial.
I bought these shoes in 1982. I just want you to know.
But I view that as meaning that for me and anybody younger than me, we've lived our entire lives in the Reagan era. So the Reagan era begins in 1980. And I would argue that era, or you could call it the neoliberal era, whatever you want to call it, continues almost to this day. And now it's collapsing. Because none of the prescriptions that were offered in this so-called consensus around how to create growth, none of them worked. They worked to create growth in terms of numbers on a page, but they didn't work in terms of delivering the kind of security and prosperity to American families in a place like the industrial city where I live.
But you use the term neoliberal, which is a term very often used by Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, people on the left, understandably, to describe. Your image out there is, in fact, somebody who's closer to what used to be called or is called the neoliberal consensus, somebody who's certainly more of a centrist or a centrist liberal. Do you reject that characterization?
Yeah, I think those characterizations are only useful for people who try to align all of us on some left-right spectrum.
Why shouldn't they?
Because it's outlived its usefulness. Look, I led the field in proposing democratic reforms that to this day some candidates supposedly on my left haven't embraced. I also am a candidate who believes that Medicare for all is not as attractive as Medicare for all who want it, that gives people the choice. So one of those you might say puts me on the center, another one puts me further out. There's a position on criminal justice reform that not only I and fellow Democrats hold, but some conservatives and libertarians are starting to embrace. And so we're living through a real scrambling of some of these ideological labels, and I think that's a healthy thing.
Can I jump in on Medicare for all versus Medicare for all who want it? And I totally understand the point that you have, 150 million people that are on private insurance now, and likely, certainly in the beginning, they're not going to want to leap out of it into the unknown. That's the dilemma, certainly, that Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders faces in the argument. The dilemma that you face, it seems to me, is that Medicare for all who want it can come off to some audiences as a fancy way of having your cake and eat it too when you can't.
Why not?
Because if enough people don't want to be involved in Medicare for all, will it be adequate to have Medicare for those who want it?
Yeah, I mean, this is how public alternatives work. We talk about this like healthcare is the only place we've ever contemplated a public alternative. But actually, things like internet service providers, my fellow mayors have been doing it. And it's remarkable what happens in the private sector when you have a public challenge. The way I come at it, I guess, is just rooted in a certain humility about what's going to happen, because one of two things will happen. Either there really is no private option that's as good as the public one we're going to create, which means everybody migrates to it, and pretty soon it's Medicare for all. Or some private plans are still better, in which case we're going to be really glad we didn't command the American people to abandon them whether they wanted to or not. And I'm neutral on which one of those outcomes happens, because it's not... The core principle for me is not whether or not the government is your health insurance provider. The core principle for me is that you get covered one way or the other. That's what Medicare for All Who Want It entails.
Are you not among those Are you not among those who looks north to Canada or east to the obvious European countries and said, I wish we had that instead of this?
Well, I certainly wish we had the improved economic efficiency of pretty much every other developed country, which spends less of its healthcare dollar on administrativia relative to healthcare, actual patient care compared to us, and has better health outcomes as a rule to show for it. Look, I lived in the UK for 2 years as a student. They have, not only is the government in charge of health insurance, it's in charge of health care, right? If you're a doctor, you work for the government. And even there, there is a system of private insurance and private care. So we're not really emulating a European system if we're saying that we're just going to order the private sector out of existence in the healthcare. What we're doing is something different, and I don't think it's a very attractive vision.
Do you think the rhetoric of Medicare for all is, when you hear AOC talk about it, or Bernie Sanders, or Elizabeth Warren, is pandering in some way?
It's not for me to say what motivates them.
Sure it is. You're running against them.
I'll say this. What sounds good on a debate stage isn't always the right answer. And we're obviously in the phase now where we're on debate stages a lot. But I think my mentality as a mayor is that you should only make promises that you're prepared to keep. There's no alternative facts when you're a mayor, right? If there's a hole in the road and you didn't fill it in, and somebody calls you out on it, you don't get to say, that's fake news, it's a great road, there's no hole in it. Because like they'll look at the hole and they'll know. So even though on one hand, I am a big believer in bold solutions, whether it's on democratic reform or even on healthcare, where what I'm proposing, just to be really clear, is the biggest, boldest transformation of American healthcare in more than 50 years, I also think it calls for a certain level of humility about how to get it done, instead of the arrogance of saying, I've figured it out, I know exactly how many years it will take to deliver, I'm going to put your healthcare at risk that I was right, and it's my way or the highway, here we go. I just come at it from a different perspective.
It is rough, though, for a voter to know the granular detail of every politician's record, whether as a mayor, as a senator, congressman. Unfortunately for your campaign, you got derailed because you had a controversy in South Bend where you had a white police sergeant shoot a 54-year-old black resident. You left the campaign trail to deal with that, and it was very rough. People saw some tough footage of you being confronted and the rest, and rightly or wrongly, an impression deepened about you and race, and the polls suggest that you have very, very, very little black support. Do you think you've been wrongly branded in some way, and what can you do about it?
Yeah, I think that people who actually come to South Bend will see how we are wrestling with tough problems. I mean, there are few...
But they won't. They voters are where they are. Yeah. It's very hard for them to...
Well, part of my job, though, is to bring people to South Bend, even if you can't literally come. I can give you a sense of what it is like to sit down with activists, with community members, with pastors, and work through how we hold our community together. And we have faced issues around race and policing, as every diverse city has, from my first weeks on the job. And I would not have seen my support in the black community grow over the years in our city if I hadn't found a way to include people, even without pretending that we were going to fix it overnight. It's not that simple, of course. I talk about it with majority white audiences as well as with majority black audiences, but incredibly good response on the Douglas Plan, which is designed to be as ambitious as the Marshall Plan, but right here in the United States for dealing with systemic racism.
You should probably explain what the Douglas Plan is.
Well, the idea is we've learned the hard way as a country that just replacing a racist policy with a neutral one is not enough to deliver equality. And if we want to deal with inequity in this country, we have to invest. And we have to recognize it's systemic. So, for example, in South Bend, when we're at the table working through an issue around racial justice in policing, by the end of that hour, we're not only talking about race and policing, we're talking about economic empowerment. It's why I'm proposing we triple the number of black entrepreneurs in the country and set a 25% goal for the federal government to do business with businesses owned by people who've been historically disadvantaged. But it's not just the entrepreneurship side either. It's health, it's home ownership, it's access to voting. education, all of these things are connected. And so the Douglas plan is intended to be a systematic, intentional, and well-funded response. And I am now convinced that if we don't tackle that in my lifetime, it could wreck the American project in my lifetime.
Are you prepared to make reparations part of the process of tackling that?
Yeah, so I support H.R. 40, which is the bill to create the Reparations Commission, but I don't think we have to wait for that process.
But H.R. 40 is an exploratory committee. So I think for a lot of people, that seems not enough.
Well, that's what the Douglas plan is about. Don't wait for that to start taking steps that are reparative. And the thing you got to remember here is that this is not just about going back and trying to change something in a distant history. This is about how history has followed us. That is why this is so urgent.
I take your answer as entirely serious and sincere. The numbers are tough for you, though. You're getting 0%.
But
hang on. You're getting 0% in South Carolina at the moment. And a narrative, rightly or wrongly, and I want you to answer it, has taken hold, certainly among your opponents or people who are skeptical of your candidacy, that you are very popular, about, particularly among well-educated whites, and by extension, what's known as the donor class in American politics. Why are they wrong?
Well, first of all, I'm doing as well as many of those opponents. It depends which poll you pick, of course. But there is only one candidate who has a commanding lead among black voters. Now, one of two things is true. Either that candidate has such a masterful command of the issue of race in America that black voters will stay loyal to him no matter what.
You're talking about Joe Biden here.
Yes. Yeah. Or things are likely to change as voters continue to sort through their options and see what we have to offer. And I'm betting on the latter.
You're in the midst of what I've always thought is a pretty cockeyed process. The way we get a Democratic nominee through the route of Iowa, New Hampshire, and all these steps and steak fries and all the rest, some of it's beautiful, some of it's inspired.
The
deep fried
really
donut is excellent
thing.
Too. But how do you break through? Because your polling is where it is. It's a crowded field. Some of it's dynamic, some of it's not. How do you break through? What's the scenario?
Well, there's kind of two phases to this. The first phase brings us to where we are now. So in terms of breaking through, I've advanced past roughly 20 of my competitors, which is not bad for somebody nobody'd heard of in January. There are admittedly a few more big hills to climb. And I think where this is going to shake out is if you really do want the candidate with the most years of Washington experience, the most familiar face possible, then you've got your choice. And if you want the most ideologically, conventionally left candidate you can get, then you've got your choice. Most Democrats I talk to are looking for something else. And that's where I come in.
Pete Buttigieg is vying for the Democratic nomination and currently polling at second place in the state of Iowa. The Iowa caucuses take place in February. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Much more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The deadline for the UK to leave the European Union has once again been pushed. Prime Minister Boris Johnson failed to meet his October 31st deadline. Now, if you've been following Brexit closely at all, first of all, give yourself a pat on the back because that's not easy. Second, you've probably heard the term Irish backstop. That refers to the border between the Republic of Ireland in the south and Northern Ireland. That border, barely 300 miles long, has become the third rail of the Brexit process, such as it is. My colleague, Patrick Radden Keefe, thankfully, has a much better grasp of the history here than I do, and especially how the border has such profound implications for the future of the UK and Europe as well. Patrick is the author of Say Nothing, a brilliant book about the Irish Troubles.
When we talk about Ireland, the country of Ireland today, we don't actually mean the whole island of Ireland. What that refers to is 26 counties, which is most of the island, but not the six counties of Northern Ireland, which actually are part of the United Kingdom. And so these are two different countries divided by a border. And that border has a long and tense and tragic history.
Strabane is a border town. The Irish Republic is 500 yards away across a river. This is where the Provisional IRA have their base, and this is where they retreat to, across a border that is notoriously difficult to patrol.
The IRA said it was warning people to stay away from military...
During a three-decade conflict known as the Troubles, there was basically a war fought over that border. You had the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which is a paramilitary organization, fighting to erase the border, to kick the British out of Ireland once and for all and actually reunify as 32 counties. And then you had loyalist groups, which were loyal to the British crown, fighting to preserve the identity of Northern Ireland as part of the UK, the British army, the police in Northern Ireland. And it was a long and bloody conflict in which 3,600 people died. But the conflict ended in 1998 with the Good Friday Agreement.
The two prime ministers emerged just before six this evening to inaugurate the historic agreement they hope will usher in a new era for the island.
And what happened was that that border, that source of tension, this place where there were gun turrets and, you know, guys with guns who would check your vehicle as you were passing through and check your papers, it seemed to just melt away.
An agreement that unites loyalist and Republican, unionist and nationalist leaders in a wide-ranging historical accord.
Until 2016.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must...
When voters in the United Kingdom voted for Brexit, the question of the border suddenly became very fraught. Because when the UK leaves the EU and Ireland stays in the EU, then that soft border between Ireland and Northern Ireland could suddenly change dramatically. It would have to have customs checkpoints, immigration checkpoints. It becomes a hard border, basically, patrolled by authorities on both sides. And that would immediately threaten the peace that's mostly held on the island for 20 years now.
It's a very complex border. It is 300 miles long. The border weaves in and out of villages, around villages, in and out of farmland, and in and out through locks, through lakes, through rivers. And it divides communities as well.
Simon Carswell is public affairs editor at the Irish Times and the former U.S. correspondent for the Irish Times and an old friend of mine. He has been covering Brexit, like many journalists in England and Ireland, but doing so from an interesting vantage point.
My plan for reporting around Brexit was always going to be around the people. It was all about who are the people affected by Brexit and what's it going to mean for them in their daily lives.
What Simon has been doing is traveling around the border in the Republic of Ireland and in Northern Ireland and talking to regular people and trying to find out how the changes that may come with Brexit will affect their lives.
When it comes to Brexit, Brexit is all about change. And the place that it was going to be changed most is along the only land border with the United Kingdom, and that's in Ireland.
Let's go back to your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a number of different places. We moved around quite a bit. I actually spent the first 2 years of my life in Dublin before we moved to Virginia in County Cavan, not far from the border. And I lived there till I was seven.
Always in the Republic?
Always in the Republic. But my parents were from Belfast, so we would have experience of crossing the border several times a year to go see my grandmother in Northern Ireland and see my relatives.
And tell me about that. What was the border like back then during the Troubles?
My earliest memories of the border was we would cross at the main road from Dublin to Belfast near Newry. For a long period of time, it was a customs border where your car might be stopped. So my memory of crossing was late at night. Often we would cross, going up there for a long weekend. And it was dark, really kind of quite eerie when you would cross the border and you'd see in the shadows at the edge of the road, you'd see British Army soldiers crouched down, holding guns and making sure that all of the traffic coming through, there's no threat there. And really just primed for action, really, in case something happened.
So then 1998, you get the Good Friday Agreement, which is this landmark peace deal, which ends this grinding three-decade war, really. For the sake of contrast, tell me about crossing the border today.
Well, crossing the border today, you wouldn't even know you've crossed a border. What's very clear when you go and visit these communities is they don't think there's a border there at all, because for the past 20 odd years, it's been invisible. So they go about their business crossing this border over and back again over the course of the day. And in many occasions, when you talk to the people, they don't know how many times they cross the border in a day.
Because they're not even thinking about it.
No, they're not even thinking about it. There are no signs there. There's nobody stopping you. So really, it makes no difference to them at all, because there is, to all intents and purposes, this invisible border.
I want to play a clip, actually, of some school kids that you visited with in a town called Crossmaglen, which is just off the border in Northern Ireland and had been a real flashpoint during the Troubles.
So one half of my house is on the Republic of Ireland and the other side of my house is on Northern Ireland.
Which part of the island do you sleep on?
I sleep in Northern Ireland, but my living room would be in the Republic of Ireland.
Can you just tell me a bit about this school and that conversation, how you came to meet those kids and how they're thinking about all this?
I went to St. Patrick's Catholic Primary School or Elementary School in Crossmaglen, which is about 3 kilometres across the border in South Armagh, Northern Ireland. This was a school that was frequently caught in the crossfire, literally caught in the crossfire, where in an IRA attack on the very famous British Army barracks in Crossmaglen, right in the town. So an IRA unit would open fire on the barracks, British soldiers would fire back, and this school was caught in the crossfire. And the principal of the school pointed out various bricks in the wall of the school that faced the barracks, and he pointed out those are the bricks that needed to be replaced as a result of bullets striking the wall during the gunfights. So the kids all had these stories where they had aunts or uncles or their parents that they had crouched under tables when bullets were coming across and hitting the school. And they were very fearful that this is what Brexit might lead to.
My mommy, she went to our school when she was younger, and she told me that when she was there, she had to go under the table and she saw a bullet fly across and it went through the 2 windows.
So these are children who've grown up after the Good Friday Agreement. Their whole lives have happened during peacetime, but it sounds like they're very aware of the fragility of that peace.
They're extremely aware of it. They're aware, while they didn't live through it, through the stories of their families have told, that this was a bad time and that they don't want to return to it.
And you also went out and spoke with truck drivers who actually do crisscross the border every day, bringing goods back and forth.
There's thousands of people going to and from work every day, you know, crossing the border, the hard border. You know, it just isn't going to work. You have to get to your work. You know, it's one small country. I don't even think the politicians know that much. you know, judging by what's being said and what's being told. Nobody really knows what's going to happen until it happens. And that's the scariest thing of it all, is that not even the people in charge know. So how the hell can we?
I took, for example, the busiest crossing over the border, the Dublin-Belfast Road, the A1. This is the four-lane highway that crosses the border. And I just, as an exercise, I looked at the traffic over the course of one 24-hour period. And in that time, you had about 25,000 vehicles crossing over that day.
Wow.
About 18,000 cars. But crucially, you had 6,600 goods vehicles. Now, if you put up any kind of check, that's going to mean your goods are not going to get to the supermarkets as quickly as they should. That will result in issues around availability. So you'd have certain products wouldn't have the same shelf life. And so what that will mean is ultimately people are going to have to pay more for their food because of these additional costs.
I want to play another clip. This is a woman named Mary Casey who you spoke with. And her father was actually killed in a bombing of a customs point in 1972.
He was doing the run that morning for somebody that was going to a wedding. And he went in to get his book stamped in the customs. And they were on the way out when they met the IRA coming in with the bomb.
Well, I was looking in particular at the operation of customs posts along the border. And I thought, well, what was the worst attack, the deadliest attack on a Northern Irish border customs post during the Troubles? And there were quite a few. I think there's about 480 odd incidents over the 30-year period of the Troubles. And I came across this extraordinary story of this bomb attack on the Newry Customs House. And what happened was a team of three IRA men walked into the customs house. Ordinarily, they would go in, they would shout something, shout a warning, and they would leave the bomb and they would all leave and the bomb would explode and destroy the customs house. On that occasion, the bomb detonated prematurely and it killed nine people. It killed the three IRA bombers. It killed two lorry drivers who were getting their papers stamped as they were bringing goods across the border. And it killed four customs officials. It was a horrendous attack.
Well, and you feel as though, I mean, you can hear it when Mary Casey talks to you, that there is this tragedy that she's had to carry around, but that it's not just a tragedy, right? It's a warning. And she feels as though people aren't listening to what the consequences might be.
I don't think any of the politicians have any idea what the border's about, really. And unless it happens at your doorstep, nobody knows, nobody understands, you know, what it's about. Somebody goes out to work that morning and they come back in a
half a
plastic bag.
A lot of the conservative politicians, they don't know how it exists currently. You would have what locals in Northern Ireland along the border would call the one-day wonders, these trips by politicians from the UK where they take a visit to the border, but they don't spend any real amount of time seeing how their lives work with this invisible border, how it exists now. And indeed, Boris Johnson, the current British Prime Minister, hasn't visited the border to see how it would affect at all. It was certainly not in his time in recent times since the Brexit referendum. So that sense of frustration that people along the border feel is that the British politicians just don't get it because they don't really understand how it exists now and what the Good Friday Agreement and being a member of the European Union has meant and how much easier it has made life along the Irish border.
And tell me, Simon, I mean, there's been a great deal of talk over the last couple of years since it became clear that the Irish border would potentially be such a sticking point for Brexit about a return of violence, you know, either in the extreme case, a return of something that looks like the Troubles or at least something more marginal around the border. How justified are those fears?
I think they are justified in the sense that there is a concern that if you do put up any kind of physical infrastructure, it would be regarded as a target because of all of the political baggage that would come with having any kind of sign of partition on the island again. I spoke to some former IRA men, and these are veterans of the Troubles, and their view was they think it's overplayed. Actually, it was interesting to hear from them. But there are others who say, well, it's not the old veterans of the Troubles that we need to worry about. It's the younger people. It's these new paramilitary groups that are springing up, the new IRA and various dissident Republican groups along the border, and how they might react. And there have been some very explicit warnings by those groups if there are any kind of checks or any kind of posts put up along the border, then we will target them. And the police service in Northern Ireland have issued a similar warning, and they've gone so far as to say, well, we won't police them if they are put up.
So the police have actually said that in Northern Ireland?
Yes, they've made
one. That if these installations did go up, they wouldn't police them?
They have made that warning, that if there are installations going up along the border, then they would not police them. They see them as a threat from Republican groups.
Who would police them?
Well, this is the challenge that would come from the practicalities of enforcing a customs border. And I think it's one of the reasons why Boris Johnson has decided to come up with his plan B, which has agreement from the European Union. This new plan is to push the border, both the customs border and the regulatory border, into the Irish Sea. And what that means is having checks at the ports of Northern Ireland and the ports of England and Scotland.
But if you do what Johnson's proposing and instead shift the border off the island, isn't there a danger that loyalist groups, people in Northern Ireland who are loyal to the British Crown, will feel this is kind of a de facto reunification of Ireland, which they would resist?
And this is exactly what's happening. There have been warnings from the police service in Northern Ireland that there could be unrest amongst loyalists because of this solution. Those people would think that, well, you're potentially undermining Northern Ireland's place in the Union, in the United Kingdom. And what you've seen, actually, from a very kind of practical point of view, is that anyone born in Northern Ireland can apply for an Irish passport. And you have seen a flood of applications from Northern Ireland from people who are looking to take out Irish citizenship because it gives them EU citizenship. And what they're arguing is some pockets of loyalism are arguing that this is a precursor to United Ireland. This would create, as you say, de facto economic United Ireland. And they're unhappy about that. They see this as a slippery slope to United Ireland.
And when it comes to this notion of the reunification of Ireland, potentially, the Good Friday Agreement created a mechanism, what they call the consent mechanism, where eventually if there is at some point a referendum and a majority of people vote to reunify, then that will have to happen. It's a fear, as you said, of unionists that this might happen, but it also seems to be something that at least some Irish Republicans have regarded as an opportunity, that Brexit, by forcing people in Northern Ireland to choose between being part of the EU and the UK, might actually create circumstances in which you could see a referendum at some point. So do you think there could be a referendum at some point in the next decade?
I think there would be huge pressure to avoid that referendum because it's a very tricky political conundrum to put to the people. And I also think that while many people in the Republic of Ireland would be quite keen and have a hope that there would be United Ireland in their lifetime, I think it would bring forward some very difficult conversations. There are a million people on the island of Ireland who are Protestant and regard themselves as unionist and British and want to retain that link with the Union and in the United Kingdom. So I think everyone would feel, maybe the exception of Sinn Féin, would feel that this is the right time. They're indeed calling for a border poll. They'd want to see it happen. But I think others would probably feel, well, this needs to be a bit more measured. This debate cannot take place in the kind of frenetic, frenzied debate around Brexit. We need to have, this is a conversation for another day and shouldn't be forced through because of Brexit.
Well, I suppose if there's one thing we've learned from Brexit, it's that it's one thing to have a referendum. It's another thing to work out the details of what it would actually look like.
Well, this is it. And when the question was asked, do you want to leave the European Union in 2016 in the UK? I don't think people really knew what that meant. Like, what is Brexit? What does Brexit mean? That's what this whole 3.5 year process of leaving the European Union for the UK has been so complex. They don't know what it means. They don't know what kind of Brexit they want. They don't know whether they want a soft Brexit or a hard Brexit or a Brexit in name only. And that's why this process has been so tricky.
Simon, thanks so much for talking to us and for your amazing reporting.
Thank you very much.
Simon Carswell is the public affairs editor for the Irish Times, a daily paper based in Dublin. And Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of Say Nothing and other books. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The very first book by Carmen Maria Machado was a finalist for the National Book Award. It's a collection of short stories that are not fantasy exactly, but maybe kind of fantasy adjacent. Her new memoir, In the Dream House, was just published, and it's getting some rave reviews. Machado lives in Philadelphia. Last year, she took us on a short trip back home to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to visit one of her favorite childhood haunts.
We are at the Allentown Farmers Market, which is on the Allentown Fairgrounds. That building over there at the end of the parking lot is where I was born. Not like the farmers market, that would be amazing. But no, I was born in that hospital. Let's go inside. Oh, it smells so good in here. It looks exactly as I remember it. These signs are so old. I just sort of distinctly remember my mother bringing me here, and I guess it sort of triggered this like lifelong love of markets, like indoor markets. It's weird because it's like there's a high ceiling, but then like the individual little shops have their own like mini ceilings or like mini roofs. Each little one has its own little sign. Chicken pies made fresh. O'Brien's, fresh bread, salads.
Say hello. You guys need anything else today?
I think that was it, yeah. I'm very particular. My great-grandmother and my grandmother are Austrian, and they're very just so, very fussy. My own mama, God bless her, she would like refold napkins for use later. And everything just had its place, and everything was very just so, and I am that way, for better or for worse.
Good morning, what a beautiful day. Oh my goodness, what a beautiful day. I'd like to tell you about a bunch of great vegetables on the ground for it. Great saving specials.
Dilly beans! Okay, that's what we want. They're like pickled green beans, and they're amazing. Okay. Hi, can I please have a raspberry bear claw?
Cheese Danish are the best.
Oh, he's pushing my cheese Danish.
Well, these look beautiful.
Anything else?
I know.
$175.
Oh my God. You know what that tastes like? Church. I've always sort of taken pleasure in like the specific aesthetic experiences of places like this. Like, I'm really interested in sensory details, and I think that people who have read my work, who've become familiar with my work, are like, yes, like sentences and details are like so specific. And that's not like artificial. Like, it's not like I go in and I'm like, I must make this detail pop. But rather, the way that I perceive the world is this very like these heightened sort of aesthetic beats or pulses. I don't know if it's like you can trace it back to here or just like this was like the first time in my life that I can remember like having that really strong aesthetic reaction to a place.
Have a good day. Enjoy it.
My guess is if you were to like strap like sensors to me, I would react to a place like this the way I would react to dogs. It's like I'm just flooded with serotonin. And I feel like when I'm in here, like I'm like, oh, this is so nice. So it's this like very weird combination of like stimulation and relaxation. Maybe this is like my church. I'm not religious anymore, but I do. I'm like, maybe this is how church felt. I don't remember. It's been a long time, but there's something about this space that, yeah, it just makes me feel just content. Like, I don't believe in heaven, but if I did believe in heaven, I bet it'd be like a giant farmer's market where you have infinite money and you're always a little hungry, but like not too hungry. And there's lots of pickle stands. That's what I think.
Carmen Maria Machado at the Allentown Farmers Market. Her new memoir is called In the Dream House. You can find some of Machado's essays at newyorker.com. If you got hungry listening to her, you better get a snack because in a minute, our food correspondent Helen Rosner joins me, and I don't think she's bringing enough for all of us. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every now and then, I check in with one of our writers about what's on their minds, what's interesting them lately, and they give us a few recommendations. I don't mean to pick favorites, God forbid, but I will say this. When Helen Rosner comes around, she brings samples.
Lately, I have been irrationally and beautifully obsessed with lasagna. So I made you a lasagna.
I'm so happy.
Do you want to do the honors?
Oh my God, do I. Cheese-covered beauty. Why are we even talking? Pick up a fork.
Do we have forks right here? Oh. I know that for pick three, one of the they're supposed to be like, read this book, listen to this CD. I'm just like, lasagna. It's one of my things. It's not a commercial product. This particular lasagna is a recipe from a cookbook that came out a month or two ago called Lasagna. It's an entire book dedicated to lasagna by Anna Hazel, and it's just delightful. And my favorite thing about this book is that she got a blurb for the book from probably the world's ultimate expert on lasagna, Jim Davis, the creator of Garfield.
Whoa. Jim Davis, the creator of Garfield, is the world's foremost lasagna expert?
I mean, it depends on how much we are going to buy into the fiction of a fictional universe, but Garfield, I think, is the ultimate connoisseur of lasagna.
Okay.
And Jim Davis as the god of Garfield.
Here we go. Oh, you killed it. You killed it.
Oh, that's really good.
Okay, program's over. We're just going to eat this thing.
So my hypothesis about lasagna, I actually have several. My primary lasagna hypothesis is that anything that makes a good pizza makes a good lasagna.
Really?
So the one that I made for you is the classic lasagna bolognese, a bechamel, mm-hmm. a bolognese sauce, fresh pasta, though I used a little trick for this, and I didn't make pasta from scratch and roll it out. I bought egg roll wrappers.
Egg roll wrappers.
Egg roll wrappers. This is the great
not store-bought lasagna noodles.
No, those are too thick. So it turns out that the wonton wrappers or the egg roll wrappers that in the grocery store are right. in the sort of by the tofu in the produce section, they're pasta. They're flour and water. And they are the perfect cheat method to make a fresh pasta lasagna.
Egg roll wrappers for lasagna.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent tip. Are there more exotic lasagnas that don't involve the usual bechamel, bolognese.
Oh, yeah. Restaurants are doing really interesting things with presentation. There's a restaurant that just opened in Miami that's doing this bizarre kind of cross-sectionally lasagna that looks almost like a slice of, an agate or some sort of beautiful layered stone. They're cool looking and pretty and nostalgic, yeah. And everybody gets psyched when a lasagna lands on the table.
Absolutely. I've never been more psyched than I am now. Okay. Is there another choice you've got?
So I was hoping to bring you a brand new jar of this sauce, but instead I'm going to give you a half full one from my own personal fridge because this is sold out everywhere. It's that good. This is a sauce called...
Whoa. I put my nose and inhaled deeply, and what is that? It says coconut cilantro chutney. And the brand is Somali Foods.
The brand is Bas Bas Sauces.
Bas Bas Somali Foods, right.
B-A-S-B-A-A-S.
Is this easy to find?
It is. It's easy to find on their website if you go to basbassauce.com.
Oh, that is really good. And what do I put that on?
Everything. everything.
That is superb.
It's phenomenal. And the woman who makes these sauces also has an incredible story. Her name is Hawa Hassan, and she was born in Mogadishu. And her family fled as refugees when she was a young child. And she eventually was able to come to the U.S. and grew up in Seattle. But her mother wasn't able to come to America with her, and they were separated for something like 15 years. And when they finally reconnected, it was the Somali food of her childhood that they sort of reestablished their relationship over. So what do you taste?
It has a late-breaking kick. It's vinegary and a lot of lemon juice and jalapeno ground up in there. And there's coconut, cilantro, garlic, salt, whatever's in there. That is something. And what, so seriously, what would you put that on?
I've been making a lot of sort of chickpea curries, like my quick dinner is I sort of dump a can of chickpeas in with a bunch of spices and a little bit of coconut milk. And then I just drizzle this on top at the end.
That would make your dinner rise up and walk at attention, I think. It's pretty great.
It's a beautiful sauce. I'm obsessed with it.
So Helen, you have another pick. What is it?
Yeah, it's a cookbook. It's called Jubilee by Tony Tipton Martin, and it is a book that is just sort of this extraordinary historical cookable compendium of the food of African-American history.
This is really beautifully done. There's a photograph here of mashed turnips and carrots with rum that it should be outlawed. It's so good looking, some of these things. It's really, this is gorgeous.
The food is
what's phenomenal. What's some of your favorites in here?
Right now, I'm particularly obsessed with a recipe in here for fruit fritters, which the recipe is with apples, but I've also made it with pears, and she suggests trying it with bananas or plantains, which I think is brilliant. But you make a pretty simple batter with flour and milk and eggs, and you add a ton of spices to it and a little bit of rum, which is the secret ingredient, and chopped up fruit, and you drop it in a deep fryer, and you make these gorgeous fritters.
So tell me a little bit about Toni Tipton Martin herself.
She is a scholar and editor and writer. She was a food editor at a major newspaper for a long time, and realized as she was working on major food stories that there were very few cookbooks by Black chefs and Black cookbook authors in the libraries of the test kitchens where she often found herself. And, you know, so each of the recipes in here has almost a, you know, a scholarly citation. I don't want to make the book sound inaccessible or boring.
No, it's incredibly inviting looking. It's the opposite of, yeah, you know, scholarly auteur. It looks fantastically delicious. Every other page is a beautiful photograph. There's a roast turkey in there that would stop Thanksgiving dead in its tracks.
It's amazing. I mean, those fruit fritters that I mentioned, she mentions in the headnote that the recipe is drawn from the handwritten notebooks of a Black man who was a caterer in the 1920s. Mm. I mean, there's just extraordinary threads of history behind every single one of these recipes. It's a cookbook that tells an incredible historical story and also makes freaking beautiful food.
Helen Rosner, who writes about food for The New Yorker. Helen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The cookbook is called Jubilee, and it's by Toni Tipton Martin. We tried the coconut cilantro chutney from Best Best Somali Foods, and the lasagna that Helen made was adapted from a book by Anna Hazel. I didn't save you any lasagna, but you gotta ask yourself, would you have saved any for me? I'm David Remnick, and I want to thank you for joining me today, and I hope you'll join me next time for the New Yorker Radio Hour. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.